I'm a little overwhelmed, to be honest with you. It's not often that you get to meet true American heroes and people that are really, truly involved in the Ypsilanti community and Eastern Michigan University community as well. So I want to thank you first for coming in here. But as an introduction, sitting next to me is a man who won the Distinguished Flying Cross, a Bronze Star Medal with Oak Leaf Cluster, Gallantry Cross with Bronze Star, 27 Air Medal Awards, the Distinguished Service Cross, and has now been picked for possible upgrade to the Medal of Honor. I want to say thank you and so much welcome to Mr. Charles Kettles. Good morning, sir.
Well, good morning. Thank you.
It's hard to know where to start. I want to get as much of your story out here as possible, but let's go back to first how your family ended up in Ypsilanti. I know that your grandfather was from Ontario and made his way into Michigan and happened to bump into P.R. Cleary in the Ypsilanti area, and of course Cleary College, founded by Mr. Cleary, and that's how your family originally came to Ypsilanti, right?
That's correct.
All right, and your father, though, moved out to of the Ypsilanti area, and you didn't grow up in Ypsilanti. You started in the Lansing area?
Well, that's correct. Actually, both my parents lived in Lansing mm-hmm. when I was born, although I was born here in Ypsilanti.
Okay. All right. And then you moved eventually out of Lansing. Your father was working for Ford, right?
Well, we have to back up here.
Okay.
We lived in Lansing for many years, up to and including World War II. He had been in World War I with the Royal Air Force as a Canadian citizen. Both my parents were Canadian. And after World War I, why the two of them moved over here, actually my mother moved over here in about 1916. And where my grandfather had moved from London, Ontario, over to Ypsilanti. He had actually been headed to Chicago.
Okay.
En route by train, he ended up here in Ypsilanti and met with P.R. Cleary. How exactly they met, I have no idea. But both of them were high on education. So they had a common bond. And so my grandfather, who was not necessarily destined to go to Chicago for any particular reason, he asked PR, I guess, about housing and such in the area. And PR simply owned the house right next to him on Normal Street. And my grandfather purchased that house, and part of his family was there.
Okay. And Pierre was the president of Cleary College at that point, right?
Oh, yes.
All right.
And so that's how my grandparents ended up here in Ypsilanti.
Okay. Now, how did your parents, your father specifically, end up getting up in the Lansing area then?
Well, initially he worked for Dodge in Detroit, striping automobiles. That's when striping was done by hand.
Okay.
And on the side, he did some flying instructing in the Detroit area.
And this is between World War I, World War II?
Correct.
All right.
And so then he really wanted to get back into aviation. And he then went up to Lansing, interviewed for a job with SKF Flying Service. And then, excuse me. Then he, at the same time, that was in Lansing.
Mm-hmm.
And concurrent with that, he was working on the side for an airline and I guess throwing baggage or whatever else. And eventually he then got a job with the state of Michigan flying for the governor and various departments. They had two aircraft. Initially, they were a Stinson S-10, and later they got a Howard. When World War II came along, the following morning after December 7th, my father got up earlier than usual, I guess, and went down, sat in front of the governor's office waiting for him to show up, and told the governor that he wanted to be relieved of his responsibilities so that he could go volunteer for active duty with the military. And the governor's response, as I understand it, was, well, so what am I going to do for a pilot? My father said, well, you won't need one because the government will take your aircraft. They would need them. He said, in that case, I guess may as well. He went down to Romulus at that point, and there were some 200 pilots there at Romulus to volunteer for service. Out of the 200, there were only two that had instrument credentials, and because that was rather unique at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And he and the other one was an was an American Airlines pilot. So that's where he entered, and it was with the Air Transport Command.
And how old were you at this point?
Well, 41, I would have been 11 years old.
Okay, so do you remember your dad doing this?
Oh, yes.
All right.
Oh, yes.
All right, so that was probably for you a moment where obviously aviation's in your blood because of your father, but service to your country certainly too by example of your father's actions here.
Well, yes, and he'd been in World War I, of course, and flew in Italy,
right.
Sopwith Camel. And so it was supposed to be a 90-day program. I guess they were simply evaluating the needs and such. And so he technically, I guess, remained a civilian for those 90 days. Then the 90 days expired, of course, and they simply integrated him, and he became part of the Army Air Corps.
Okay. And where did he end up serving?
Well, he was regarded as old at that point because he would have been about 42, 43.
Okay.
But he had a lot of experience. So he ended up flying aircraft from the factories to wherever their requirement was, most of which were probably in Europe. And he flew most everything up to and including the B-29 during World War II.
So was he going back and forth across the Atlantic?
Yes.
Wow. Do you know how many trips he might have made?
No, I don't know. And I can't find his logbooks.
Okay.
But he also made a trip to Russia during the war, when then Secretary Cordell Hull had a meeting in Moscow. So he led the flight of two C-54s,
okay,
with Cordell Hull to Moscow. And I believe they went from down from Africa across, or from South America across to Africa and then up. Anyway, he had a rather interesting career, although he never said much about it.
No, certainly. Did he take fire? I mean, was there ever a point where, you know, lives were at risk here? Or was it a relative? I mean, pilots had a pretty short lifespan during World War II, for the most part, that were seeing combat. So, you know, to fly as many missions, I'm assuming, as he did, you know, did he ever come into a grave danger like that?
Not to my knowledge, right, because the type flying that he was doing was simply delivering aircraft to wherever the need,
right,
may be.
Right.
But so to my knowledge, he never took any fire.
All right. So when did he come back from Europe? When did he come back from the war, and you know, what was life like after that?
Well, he stayed until the end of, okay, of the war, and then was released from active duty. And there was not a position open within the state of Michigan as he had left.
Hmm.
So at that point, he went to work for Ford Motor Company, flying out of Dearborn.
Okay.
They had two 46s, C-46s, and they converted one of them to civilian use to equate to a DC-3.
So is he just flying executives around? He's kind of a private pilot for Ford at that point?
Yes.
All right. And how long did that go on?
I think till about mid-47, 48, somewhere in that time frame.
So you're getting into your teenage years at this point, and you still have a love for aviation, did you know you wanted to fly at that point?
Well, yes. And I was going to school in Dearborn at that time, high school, Edison Institute, Greenfield Village. And the strip was right across from Greenfield Village.
There. Oh, so you could see him fly.
It was part of Greenfield Village, and they had a simulator, a blue box. It was one of the forerunners of today's simulator, but there's not much similarity between that and what they have today. But anyway, I used to go play with that thing, and when I would wait and go over after school and wait for him to go home, because we lived up in Garden City. And from there, and when he left Ford Motor Company, he went back to Lansing and became chief pilot for Abrams Aerial Survey out of Lansing.
And when you graduated from high school, you came back to Ypsilanti, though. You went to Michigan State Normal College, which sitting on the campus of Eastern, now where we're at, that was what it was called at the time. Were you studying aviation here?
Negative.
All right.
when my father left and returned and went back to Lansing, that's when I moved to Normal Street, where my aunts were, to finish school in Dearborn. And so I was there about 2 years prior to coming to Eastern.
And that's when you bumped into Ann for the first time, right? Your wife, is that around that time?
Well, I had known her when we were quite small.
Right, because she's a Cleary, correct?
Yes.
All right.
But, yes, I lived next door, and Ann lived there.
All
because
right.
During World War II, P.R. Cleary had divided his home on Normal Street into four apartments because of the housing problems here.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Ann's parents moved up on Normal Street, because PR had also lost his wife in 39. So that's how I knew Ann at that point. And then, I came to school here.
And what was your focus here when you came to school?
Well, initially it was pre-med. That soon turned into engineering.
Okay.
And I stayed here about 2 years.
And then that got interrupted by when you got drafted.
Yes. Well, I had been working during the summer for Kaiser Frazier Export Corporation. And also at night I was working for American Airlines at night.
Yeah, at Willow Run, I heard that.
At Willow Run, throwing baggage and that sort of thing. They called it fleet service, I believe.
Back when there used to be passenger aircraft coming in and out of there?
Yes. Well, that was the center of it.
Yeah.
So I worked there full-time at night, and I've been working full-time at with Kaiser Frazier during the day. I decided I'd drop out. That was in the fall of 51.
Okay.
So I dropped out for the fall session. I intended to go back in January and accumulate enough money to have just one job.
Paying for college today is not much different than then. Then you were taking a little time off to
things don't change.
Yeah.
Things don't change, but the price just goes up.
Yeah,
and so that was in October or in September, of course, when school started.
Right,
October. I got a draft notice. And, I thought I went down to Fort Wayne, and then from there to Fort Custer.
Right, and you went to flight school.
Well, some time later.
Okay.
Because I thought it was great because they'd let me sleep in until 6-7 o'clock in the morning, and I could go to bed about 10 o'clock at night. So when they did my laundry, the mess hall was always there. And it seemed like a pretty good offer.
Three hots and a cot every day.
Something like that, yeah. Yes. Well, anyway, of course, went through basic training, Camp Breckenridge, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky, to officer candidate school. And went to Fort Ord, California. And a few months later, I went off to flight school. And from flight school, I went to Korea. The Korean War had been over by some 5 months at that point. The entire artillery group moved over to Japan. And then from there, I was there probably 6-8 months, I suppose. And then I went to Thailand with the 32nd Engineer Topo Unit. They were making maps of Thailand.
So you're mostly doing support services at this point? Or?
Yes. All right. Yes.
All right. How long was your stint in the military at that in your first service here? When did you come back to the States?
Well, I came back in '56, and I had fulfilled my obligation, and there was nothing happening in the world in '56. So,
When did you come back to Ypsilanti or come back to Lansing, or where'd you end up coming back to at that point?
I came back to DeWitt, Michigan, where my brother and I established a Ford dealership.
Oh, wow! So in the '50s, you and your brother were running a Ford dealership
in late '50s.
Okay.
And in 63, of course, Vietnam boiled up.
Right.
And I volunteered to go back on active duty.
Well, they needed pilots.
And yes.
So just out of curiosity, did you hear about that and you volunteered, or did they start contacting people that they knew had recently come out of service with experience as pilots, or how did that work?
I had stayed in the reserve units, 4th of the 20th Artillery in Lansing. And I had gone off to the artillery school because my branch had been armor. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the advanced course for artillery. And that's where the need was clear.
Okay.
And so I, rather than move on, I simply volunteered to come back on active duty.
So 63, you put your hand up and said, I'll take that duty on. Now,
yes.
Did you know that you would be flying helicopters at that point, or did you just know that they needed pilots?
They needed pilots, and I was fixed-wing qualified only. Now, from there, they sent me to France. That seemed like the wrong direction, but anyway, that was not the first surprise I ever had in the military. And en route to Europe, they sent me to Fort Walters, Texas.
Okay.
For helicopter transition training, and then on to Europe, France. And while I was there in France, then I got cross-trained into the UH-1 in Germany, and then, of course, assigned back to the United States to marry up with a new unit that was being formed at Fort Benning, Georgia, the 176th Assault Helicopter Company.
And at that point in Vietnam, the idea really was very strongly focused on the helicopter support as kind of like the flying cavalry. You were getting guys in and out.
That's it.
All right. So pilots obviously very important at this point. And where are we at now? We're about 64, 60s or so at this point?
Well, I arrived in Vietnam in the beginning of 67.
Okay.
And spent one tour at that point.
So you first set foot in country in 67. Now, I hate to ask this way, but what was it like? I mean, it's hard, I think, from my perspective, being obviously younger and not experiencing something like this in my generation. I mean, what was it like? I mean, to go over there knowing what you had to do?
Well, I guess there weren't any real surprises, but unlike what you'd probably see in the movies, we spent a lot of time when there was really nothing happening.
Okay.
And it was only when we went out and stirred it up that it really happened, because the base the bases were pretty secure.
Mm-hmm.
And not much action in the bases.
You did fly a lot of missions, though, while you were in country, over 200, right?
I'm not sure the number, because the number of air medals awarded are dictated by the type mission that you're flying, whether it be combat assault or whether it be simply taking food out to fire bases that are out in the boondocks, depending on which mission you were flying.
So you found yourself doing a lot of just material support, kind of ammunition runs, supply runs, that kind of thing?
Well, you get a fair amount of that. And the way the organization was, the company that is, you had three platoons, two lift platoons, and a gunship platoon. The lift platoons, of which I was one, took care of the combat assaults for 1 week. Then the second platoon would pick it up.
And so they were rotating in and out of different duties.
Yes, and the second platoon would take care of the ash and trash missions of hauling ammo or whatever else. So we just alternate back and forth.
Okay. And obviously, the way that they operate, and when you're flying those combat missions, you're kind of a sitting duck for a little while. I mean, you're flying a big green beast and setting it down, and you become a giant target while you're unloading and loading, right? So it's not the safest of occupations in country at that point.
Well, yeah, that's pretty accurate. Right. It was very slow, of course, about 105 knots. Mm-hmm. And F-4 pilots, I guess, referred to it as the Huey as targets.
Right.
And rightfully so, but anyway.
When you were flying missions, were you carrying any kind of weaponry? I mean, were you in an assaultive capacity too, or just a support capacity?
Well, the UH-1D or H lift helicopter had a machine gun on each side.
Okay.
And, of course, you carried your own sidearm. I don't know what that was good for, but it was a .38 revolver. I guess all else you could throw it at somebody. But outside of that, well, that was the limit of here.
All right, let's talk about the day that really this honor that you received here and are being chosen for it, for an upgrade to the Medal of Honor. This is happening in 67, right? And you're flying a mission. Where was it? Is it in Duck Foe?
Well, out of Duck Foe. Okay. Duck Foe was out by the ocean.
Okay.
On the east side of Vietnam.
So let's talk about that day. I mean, was this a typical day for you? You were in your rotation. You were doing combat support at that point. And what were the days shaped up like? I mean, what were you tasked with?
Well, based upon intelligence gained the previous day from a LRP team, long range recon patrol, that had been out in that AO, they developed an assault into the area. And we began fairly early in the morning with eight helicopters. And the platoon had 11, but you always had some in maintenance.
Right.
So you normally flew with eight, and you could carry, with a Delta model, you could carry five, maybe six, depending on the density, altitude. And so we made two trips into an LZ around the base of a hill mass, and that put some 80 troops on the ground. Those 80 troops moved around the base of that hill mass and down into a valley. That they unfortunately were ambushed.
Mm.
And the hill mass to the north of them, which would have been on their right side, was about probably 1,600 feet and rather steep.
So they put out the call then to have you guys come get them?
Well, they got into a firefight, of course, and got pretty well mauled over. They called for reinforcements. So we took the 8 helicopters and another 80 troops and went back out. And we pulled out the wounded after dropping off the replacements. Excuse me. We got into a lot of fire ourselves, and I'm not sure exactly how many helicopters got hit, but the one I had got stitched pretty badly. It had some 29 holes. Now, I didn't stop to check them, but after it got back to the foe, that someone checked it. Anyway, they had stitched the fuel cell, and so the fuel gauge was going down in unusual.
Right, so you're flying back to base, and you're looking like you're running out of fuel at that point.
Well, yeah, I wasn't sure it was going to get back. Right. But anyway, we might very well have had to do an auto rotation. But anyway, it did get back, and that ended that aircraft.
But you had those spares on hand, were your ones that were in maintenance, so you went and grabbed another one?
Well, none of those were available.
Okay.
So later in the day, just about time sunset, the battalion commander called for emergency extraction of the remaining troops that were in the LZ, which was 44.
All right.
The four of those were members of my platoon because they had taken a mortar round on the mast of their helicopter, and they became infantry troops again.
So some of your guys were down there on the ground fighting
alongside.
So
four of them were mine.
Okay.
And we only had in the company one flyable available helicopter, and that was from the other platoon. So I borrowed that one. And operations coordinated with the battalion, aviation battalion, to have five from a sister battalion, a sister company, 161st, rendezvous with me in the proximity of the landing zone.
So the goal, I mean, you said sun's coming down there, so the goal really is get the guys out before the sun comes down, is that?
Yes. All right. Yes. So... And they came in from Chulai, which is about 30 miles up the road.
Okay.
And we rendezvoused and went in to pick them up. And or it took quite a bit of fire. And because the design or the terrain and such, we went in a trail formation. And then a standard procedure, because I'm sitting in lead, a trail will tell me when the troops are loaded.
So you're kind of single file, you know, front to back. All right.
Yes. So we, he told me that they were all on board, and we departed. At about 1,500 feet in doing a reverse course back toward Duck Foe, I was advised by the CNC ship, command and control aircraft, which had the brigade commander, General Matheson, on board, and the battalion commander, that 8 troops were still in the still down there.
And I can imagine, not to interrupt you, that initial extraction probably drew a lot of attention from enemy fire at that point, right? So they're looking for your guys, and you know, I mean, probably when you hear that call. And I don't want to tell you what's going through your head, but I imagine that you're thinking if nobody goes back for them, they're done for.
Well, that's right.
All right.
Yeah.
So you hear that there's 8 left behind.
Correct. 8. And I only had one on board my helicopter. I mean, it was pretty chaotic, so they went for whatever helicopter they could find.
The closest one they could jump onto.
Sure. So these 8 troops that were behind had put up a last-ditch effort to defend the LZ, and they came up out of the riverbed only to find that the helicopters were already departing.
Wow.
So with only one on board, my own helicopter, I turned the flight over to number two aircraft, told him to take them back to Duck Foe in the co-located medical facility. And I would break off when I got a beam of the troops again that were on the ground. I would break off and go back and pick them up.
Okay. Now, are you thinking, I mean, had you ever flown that heavy before with that many people on board? Or, I mean, what was your thought? Did you think you could jump in and grab all of them and get out of there? Or just not really thinking at that point, you just knew you had to go get your guys?
There are 8 troops down there.
Right.
We may have to go get them.
Right.
I knew I'd be over gross, but so what? Right. There were no options.
Really, at that point.
Yeah. We had no option available. The gunships had departed. They were low on fuel. And, of course, they thought the LZ was clear. Mm-hmm. The Air Force departed.
So you had no air support at that point.
No air support. The artillery had shut down. Oh. And so the only real element in my favor was the element of surprise. So anyway, dropped down in the steep left descending turn to the troops. I could see them from where I was.
They're taking fire at this point?
Oh, yeah. Right. They are.
Yeah.
And touchdown, and they, of course, immediately started boarding. About that time, my mortar round went off on just off the nose and took out part of each windshield and chin bubble and put shrapnel up through the cockpit between the two pilots.
That when your gunner got injured during the, is that at that point?
No, that was earlier flight when they put in the reinforcements.
All right.
That's when he was injured.
But you're taking, so you're taking really heavy fire at this point.
Well, yeah, because Charlie's got everything directed toward one helicopter and the 8 troops remaining. And the shrapnel came through and injured some of those that had boarded. And the co-pilot was flying at that point. He picked it up and it began to fishtail rather violently.
Is it because you were overweight?
Well, I'm not sure to this date what happened there. But anyway, I took controls at that point and picked it up. And I knew it was going to be heavy, and there was not proper or desirable terrain to make a running takeoff where you just leave the skids on the on the ground and to get enough forward speed to fly. So anyway, as soon as I picked it up, by the rotor RPM began to bleed off, and so I then began to trade altitude, what little I would have, a couple of feet, back down on the ground, touched the ground to get my rotor RPM back up again, because what I needed was about 40 knots forward speed to get the helicopter into what we call translational lift.
So you're essentially limping along at this point, trying to get enough speed going to get off the ground.
Yes, and if it was going to go, it would go when it reached probably 40 knots. So it took about four or five or six of those on trading altitude for RPM and RPM for forward speed.
Just I'm curious, in a moment like that, it sounds like chaos. I mean, Your windshield's gone, you're open to the elements, you're under heavy fire, you've got wounded with you, you're overloaded. I mean, do you feel that chaos at that moment, or are you just on your training and doing everything you can to just get that Huey off the ground?
That's probably about as accurate. I mean, you've got too much to do to be really wrapped around the axle.
Yeah, distraction would kill you at that point.
Well, the air conditioning was great without the windshield and chin bubble. But if it was going to fly, it would fly probably at about 40 knots.
Right. But you did get eventually off the ground, obviously.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Yes, it did. It flew like a 2.5-ton truck, but but it did fly.
What kind of altitude could you maintain in that condition?
Well, we finally got back up to normal altitude.
All right.
Just slow, but we were the hell out of there anyway.
What was that flight back like? I mean, is it... again, is it you're just laser focused getting these guys back to safety, or you know, is there a sense of relief, or not until you're back on the ground?
Well, I guess kind of nondescript, because next thing is to get these grunts back to medical facilities, because they were not all that well.
And of the eight you picked up, did they all end up making it? Do you know? Do you have follow-up on that?
Well, to the best of my knowledge,
okay.
I've only had contact with two of them, and that's only been fairly recent.
And I was going to ask you that question. I mean, obviously, you changed the destiny for eight men's lives that day by your actions, and no one really asked you to do it. You took it upon yourself to do this. Since you've talked to them recently, I mean, do you see that there are now children and grandchildren out there in the world and lives that were simply came into existence because of your choice that day?
Oh, yes. One of them was Dewey Smith. And he said, if it hadn't been for you, why, there'd be a lot fewer Smiths around today. But how many children and grandchildren he has, I'm not sure. But
well, I want to stop and I want to thank you for that. I mean, that's meritorious action for certain, and doing it on behalf of your country voluntarily is, you know, I can't overstate how incredible that is. You know, that's so thank you. What was life like after that? I mean, you fly this mission, and is this just a routine day for you at this point? You know, and you've been in country a little while, and do you pick up the next day and just keep moving forward?
Pretty much, except we didn't have any helicopters. And matter of fact, the company commander that evening suggested we go have dinner, which was not unusual. And but I sensed that he had something more serious on his mind. And we shortly after we started eating, he said, Chuck, I'm going to move you in to be the flight operations officer. I said, why? I'm quite happy where I am. And he said, well, I thought maybe you could figure out what an assault helicopter company does without any helicopters.
So what did you do?
So we did begin to get some replacements fairly soon. And some of those were repairable there at the base. The two that I flew had to be lifted by CH-47 back down to Corpus Christi Depot maintenance down in Vung Tau.
So how long then were you in Vietnam?
Well, full tour of the year.
Right. And then you re-enlisted or re-upped in 69?
Well, no, as an officer, you don't re-up.
Sorry, yeah.
You just
feel free to correct me. I'm not a military guy, so well, please.
That's fine. but so I went into flight ops, and we slowly got some helicopters back. But then I didn't stay very long before the brigade aviation officer left the brigade, and they were looking for a replacement. And the company commander of the 176 told me I was going to go up and be the replacement brigade aviation officer, which was further back from everything.
Right.
And I said, well, do I have any say in it? Because I really don't want to go up to the brigade.
Wait, did you just want to keep flying at that point?
Yes.
All right.
So he said, well, you really don't have a choice. The general said, you're it. So I went up to be their brigade aviation officer, where I stayed until I left Vietnam on that tour.
All right, and then after Vietnam, you made your way back to Texas, because you were career military at that point, right?
That's correct.
All right. What did you do in Texas?
I was with the headquarters, which was then 4th Army headquarters in Fort Sam Houston, later became 5th Army headquarters, when 5th Army headquarters out of Chicago got moved down to 4th Army takeover Fort Sam Houston. And so I stayed there about, well, I went back in 69.
Okay, so 71 you ended up coming back here, right?
So 71 I was back at Fort Sam Houston again.
Okay, right.
Initially I was to go out to the east, but anyway, I got diverted back into Fort Sam Houston again with a flight detachment, and then worked in the aviation division of then 5th Army at Fort Sam Houston.
So when did they tell you they kind of encouraged you to finish your college degree? Is that
Every time I had a call from the Department of the Army.
All right. So what was it eventually convinced you to come back to Michigan and come back to Eastern Michigan?
Well, when I got ready to go off on the second tour, my detail officer, which is what they call themselves in the Pentagon, called and said he was alerting me to return back to Vietnam. Fine. And wanted to know what I was doing about my education. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, frankly, this is the third time I've enrolled in classwork at an institution convenient to the post. And you've sent me off to TDY for something else and unable to finish it. But he said, well, what about bootstrap? And I said, well, I really don't want to bother with one of those basket weaving degrees out of Omaha. And there was a long pause, and he said, I've got one of those basket weaving degrees. I said, well, you were sending me back to Vietnam again anyway, so I guess we can't do any more than that. So that was about the end of that discussion. But I did come up to EMU to check on to see what would take to finish my degree. And my records were in the furnace room or something, which was probably quite appropriate. It's probably too bad that they didn't put them in the fire because they were not very sterling.
Did military service change you in that regard? I mean, when you came back, were you a more committed student? Or, you know, just best out of curiosity, I mean, did you have more of a focus in your life at that point?
Well, while I was at Fort Sam Houston, I was taking coursework at Our Lady of the Lake University there in San Antonio, off duty, and working toward completing the degree. When I retired after 20 years, and as a reserve officer, you were forced to retire after 20. Then I moved back up here, and finished the last, I don't know how many hours, here at Eastern. Mm-hmm. But the degree was awarded out of Our Lady of Lake University, San Antonio. Now then, following that, I then launched into a master's degree in the College of Technology and Construction.
And this is about the time, too, when you came back up here, you bumped into Ann again, right? And you hadn't seen her in a while, or is that my timing a little off there?
No, Ann and I had married at that time.
Oh, okay, all right.
We were married in 77.
Okay, all right.
And I retired in the beginning of 78. So, yes, she, of course, was here at the university.
Right, and you've set down roots in Ypsilanti at that point.
Yes.
All right. And so you got your master's at Eastern, and then following that, you helped start some new programs here at the university. What did you do at Eastern?
Well, in the College of Technology, then I was, of course, working in coursework presenting coursework in the construction field. But concurrent with that was I developed an aviation management degree. I was interested in teaching people to manage flight departments and such, because good pilots do not necessarily make good managers. And somewhat the reverse is true, although it's more in that direction. So the program was put together to give them the skills to run maintenance, operations, and that sort of thing.
And Eastern embraced that idea?
Yes.
All right. And
well, I had a lot of support from Al Rudisell to put this thing together, and Jeff Luftig, who was department head.
This is the early 80s now that you're doing this? Or?
Yes. So Jeff was a big help, in because he knew how to do the business in academia. I had come from a totally different background, and he could fill in the blanks.
And was Anne still working here at the university at that point, too? Well, what does she do here?
Well, she was in academic advising at the time we were married. Okay. She was, and then later she took a position as director of records registration and academic advising. And she retired, I believe, in 96.
Well, so long service to the university.
Oh, yeah. She'd been here since the 70s. Well.
So you started the program. Did you stick with it for several years, or how did
Yes. Yes, I was with it for, I don't know, 3 years, four okay. years.
You see a lot of kids move through the program during that time? And what were you partnering with anybody locally? I mean, did you have, you know, any kind of airports, you know, places you could take them to show how things work in the real world?
Well, I had real world brought to them.
Okay.
The maintenance maintenance manager for Coletta taught many of the classes for maintenance. Had an attorney who was a aviation law attorney, and she taught aviation law. We had Tony Adamski, who frequently taught operations and that sort of thing. He had a gentleman worked for an insurance company out of Detroit that I had known for many years in aviation. He taught insurance as applied to aviation.
And then after that, shortly after, or around that time, you found your way over to Pentastar, is that right?
Well, of course, each year you had to justify your existence, I guess, or for renewal of your position until such time at least you got received tenure. And so I went through that academic drill every year, and last year I the faculty members on the committee or whatever that was, they were not satisfied with the fact that I had not published. And my position was, when I have something worthwhile to publish, I'll do it, but not until I had attended some of these.
Well, it definitely seems to fit your personality. You seem like a very grounded, common sense kind of man.
Well, I attended a few conferences in aviation where people who were doing their publishing made presentations. And the last one there, I think there were 10 of us in the audience while this individual made his presentation. After about 5 minutes, half of them left, and pretty much I ended up, after about 45 minutes of that, and I was about the only one still there who might be listening. And I thought, if that's what they're looking for, I'm not interested.
All right, so you transitioned out.
So anyway, I didn't publish, and so anyway, they put the job up for... And they wouldn't grant tenure, or wouldn't recommend tenure, however that may work. So
you're looking for a job?
Yeah. Right. However, I came back that fall on the contract because they were unable to fill the position and stayed for an additional year.
Okay. And then from there you made your way over to Pentastar Chrysler.
Yes.
What did you do for them?
Pretty much administration in maintenance and did bidding and estimating for heavy maintenance.
Because, did you ever fly again after you got out of the military?
Oh, yeah. All right. I had an aircraft of my own. Small twin beach, a D-8 and D-95.
Kind of just travel air. A fun aircraft.
Well, I use it. Actually, I had it while I was here with the university, and I also leased the aircraft to the FAA out here at Willow Run. They operate it sometimes. It was good for transportation.
Does Ann like to fly, or did she like to fly?
Well, her point was she didn't love to fly, but she loved the pilot. So that was her response. She didn't really like to.
Perfect response.
She tended to get sick flying. But anyway, I think she saw
that you loved it.
Oh, yes. And that was one of her criticisms when we were growing up next door to each other, that both her brother, Pat, and myself were wrapped around in aviation, and she thought we should be into the books better, and she was a little bit critical. Actually,
so she knew what she was getting into, though, with your love.
Yeah, it wasn't any secret. So,
this goes back about 30 years now, though. So, but you've remained in Ypsilanti. When did you retire?
From the military in 78.
Okay.
I don't recall exactly what year I left Eastern. Mm-hmm. Then I retired probably about 94 from Pentastar.
Okay. So what's the last 20 years been like for you here in Ypsilanti? I mean, you seem like an involved person. I mean, what have you done in this community? I mean, what have you seen change? I mean, you live on Cross Street, so obviously a lot has changed in this area. I mean, what's the last 20 years been like for you?
Well, in the 80s, I was on council for about 4 years. Okay. And when I retired from Pentastar, I began a cottage project up in Canada. My grandfather had property on the lake. It's actually part of the North Channel, St. Mary's River. And there was about a mile and a half or so of lakefront that he had purchased at the turn of the
Sounds beautiful.
he had purchased that about 1900 because he had a farm there on the property. And
it stayed in your family?
Yes. Right. So anyway, I had designed a cottage and then had it put together by Lindahl Cedar Homes. And so that's where I went to supervise the construction, because although I intended to do more, Ann said, you won't live long enough to get it done yourself. So I engaged those who knew what they were doing.
Ann really sounds like your grounding force through the last 40 years of your life.
Pretty good advisor. Yeah. Yes. And once a director, always a director.
And you got that project done?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Do you still have the place up there?
Yes.
All right. So you split time? Do you go back and forth? Are you mostly here now?
Well, here except for summer.
Okay.
Now the cottage is suitable for year-round operation, and we keep the heat on up there. But we come back down here because it's pretty desolate up there in the middle of winter when the temperature gets down 40 below and the winds blow.
Just what is your thoughts on, you're obviously still living here in Ypsilanti. I mean, you're committed to this area. It's your community. You know, what keeps you here? I mean, are you just rooted here now, or, you know, you don't want to move at this point or didn't want to move 20 years ago? I mean, what kept you in Ypsilanti?
Well, there was no reason to move elsewhere. We had the cottage for the summer in Canada, a good house here on Cross Street, and comfortable, met our needs, And then, of course, when Ann had the stroke, we had moved next door to a single floor home and make it easier for Ann.
Right.
And
you mentioned that you had recently reached out to a couple of those men that made it onto your helicopter on that day of those eight. And what inspired that? Was it, did they come to you? Did you go to them? Or how did that work out?
Well, Bill Villano from Ann Arbor initiated this upgrade action some 4 years ago now. And he had been working on a veterans project or historic project or something such that. He was not satisfied with what I had given him. So he got a hold of Roland Scheck, the gunner that had been with me,
right,
on and got more information, which I guess stirred him up to get more information from additional people. So that's what had happened.
Right.
And although I had really, I had maintained contact with Scheck. Scheck lost his leg that day.
Mm.
A German national, he had gone to Canada expecting to go to Vietnam. That's what he wanted to do. He learned that they were not, in fact, going to Vietnam. We got authorization to be relieved from that job with the Canadian Army and come across the border here at Detroit,
right,
and join the American Army. And I ended up with Roland in Vietnam. Great kid.
He's still here in the Detroit area, or is he
elsewhere? No, he's out in the East Coast.
Okay.
But I maintain contact with him on a regular basis. And he has raised three children, he and his wife. One is an Army officer, one is a Coast Guard officer. The daughter is in the federal system somewhere. And
so definitely proud of Dad's service.
He's been a great kid.
Right. Did you, in the last, the 40 years following it, did you ever feel a need, or did you ever wonder what had happened to those guys, or did it just not enter your mind? I mean, I'm sure those weren't the only men you saved in your time in Vietnam. Obviously this day is a lot of focus on it, but did you just feel like that was your business there and that's what you did? And, or, did you really dwell on the guys that came back because of you?
Well, no, life moves on and things change, and they went their way, whatever that be. I never really gave it all that much thought. Stayed fairly close to Scheck and, right, and Don Long, a few others.
But then you did talk to one, you mentioned Dewey Smith, I believe you said his name was. And
yes.
Had they ever tried to find you?
No.
Okay. So they just went on their lives too.
Yes.
I imagine a lot of guys got back and just wanted to erase that part of their lives and move forward. It probably was not the most pleasant of experiences for a lot of them. So is that kind of what you discovered there, that they made a life after it and just didn't look back?
Well, yes, some of them, and one of them in particular that did provide a statement for the MOH upgrade, Ammons, he really is not too crazy about going over that turf again. And that's probably true of a lot of them. So yeah. I didn't really stretch out. If I heard from some of them, then I probably maintained contact with them.
You're respecting their distance if they wanted it.
Yeah, that's what they wanted. And my co-pilot who went in there with me, and the only person, the only crew member who made each and every flight with me was him, Ray Sechrist. And he pretty much went underground.
Right. Moved on with his life.
Yes.
Right. What inspired Billy? You mentioned, you know, a few years back that he started pursuing this upgrade. What inspired him to do that? Do you know?
Well, only that he was more curious, I guess, after he did this Veterans History program.
And that's when he learned your story.
Yes, but he wasn't satisfied that he had the whole story.
And how does that process work? I know that the Secretary of Defense just recently picked you out of a pile, basically. So what happens now?
Well, I think it's not quite picking out of a pile, but anyway, because to get to that point, it has to go through the awards branch, because someone has to put this whole thing together, and with all the witness statements, which have to be notarized, and goes before the awards branch in Fort Knox. It goes before what they call a senior board. And the senior board thinks that it has merit. They sign off. It goes up through the channels, through the chief of staff of the Army, to the secretary of the Army, to the secretary of defense, and the last stop is with the president.
Right, but you have to have a – does it take an action of Congress, though, right, to officially award it to you?
No.
Okay.
It takes an act of Congress to waive the five-year requirement. There's a requirement wherein the award is to be made within 5 years of the action.
Okay.
Obviously, we're well beyond that.
Yeah.
And it's not uncommon. It's pretty much, somewhat of a rubber stamp. But, you still have to get it through Congress.
So at some point it's going to be on President Obama's desk, and he's going to have to choose to sign it or not.
Yes.
Do you know a timeline on that?
No.
All right. But someday you'll get a call, and they'll tell you yay or nay, basically.
Well, I think that it's pretty certain that it will be approved, because the secretary, when this comes back out of Congress, back to the Secretary of State, he will send an endorsement or recommendation to the president.
Right. And I would doubt that he would go against a recommendation from that level.
Well, I would think so. Right. But
so when you do receive it, they fly you to D.C. and you meet the president, and he presents you this medal in person? Or how does that work?
I'm not sure what the mechanics are of this whole thing. Probably the presentation will be done in D.C., somewhere. Now, a friend of mine, Master Sergeant Benavides, many years ago was presented the Medal of Honor by President Reagan. And I attended that because I had initiated the upgrade from the DSC for him to the Medal of Honor. So I attended that one, but that's about the limit of my knowledge. I have no idea how it's...
You know, with your personality, and obviously I've only known you for an hour here, I'm just curious, is this important to you? And I don't want you to take that in the wrong way. I mean, if this had never happened, this upgrade action had not happened, would it have been something that you would have pursued or thought important to you to pursue? Or is this something you're accepting because other people feel that you deserve it?
I was quite content that we got 44 troops out of there.
Right.
And their names are not on the wall in D.C.
That's reward enough?
That's enough.
Right.
But the day after the action that we're talking about, the battalion commander asked me, he came down to Duck Fo, asked if I would come up to the battalion and put on paper what had really happened. I said, but that's agreeable. However, whatever I put on paper, I do not want used on my behalf for any favorable action. And if you're agreeable to that, then I'm not uncomfortable doing it.
So do you view this then as an honor, not just for you, but for the men and women that you served alongside?
There were some 74 crew members, helicopter crew members, involved in that whole day, that mission. And, of course, not all of them were wounded.
Right.
I think there were a total of 9 wounded, but Scheck was the worst. But the medal really belongs to all of them, from my perspective. And so I never expected to receive the Distinguished Service Cross. That came as a surprise. And
was that soon after, or how long did it take before that occurred?
About a year after. Okay. But that the approval authority for the Distinguished Service Cross was at headquarters level in Vietnam.
Now, do you know who put you up for that?
No, and I haven't been able to find out. I did write a letter to General Matheson a few years back. He was the brigade commander, and asked if he knew, because I was curious at that point who, because the battalion commander was a full colonel.
Right.
He was not a general. General Matheson was that's been in it probably came from General Rawson's office.
But somebody heard about your story and took it upon himself to honor you in this way.
For the Distinguished Service Cross. Right. However, when Bill Volano tried to put this thing together through then John Dingell's office, they queried St. Louis records, but nothing could be found. Probably got lost in the fire that they had a number of years ago, and because there was really nothing there to go on.
And it was all paper records at that point, obviously.
Yes.
Right? Out of curiosity, what does Anne think about all this? You know, just and obviously she loves you and she wants you to be honored, but does she think this is a lot of fuss, or you know, is she happy for you?
Well, I suppose she's. I mean, I don't know as we've had any real discussion about
right.
It's.
I just curious, you know, it seemed like, again, she was kind of your grounding force these last 4 decades, you know, 5 decades almost here. And I didn't know, you know, it seemed like your relationship would be such that she would have something to say about it. But I think maybe she's just letting you be a little bit on this one and letting you have your own time.
Well, I haven't really been all that involved in it.
Right.
Bill Volano and many people have been involved in putting this whole thing together. It's a rather thick binder, get all those statements together and all the necessary support papers and such. It fills about an inch and a half three-ring binder.
Well, thank you, sir. I thank you for your service. Thank you certainly for coming out here today. From everything I've seen and read about you, and this is certainly deserving, and I agree with you, and I was expecting your answer that you gave based on the history that I've seen, a little bit of it, and a glimpse into your life, that you know this is more important to honor those that fought alongside you than for yourself. So, and again, that just magnifies why you deserve it, to me at least. You know,
well, I think it probably does have a great deal of meaning to those who were involved. I was satisfied before. I was satisfied before they gave me the Distinguished Service Cross.
Yeah, and you know, I think from talking to you for a little over an hour here, I think one word I could describe for you with is content. I mean, you seem really content with the way your life has gone.
Well, I had, subsequent to that mission, given considerable thought as to how or it might have been done better. But frankly, having debriefed the whole thing, I don't know where we could have made any changes that would have given us a better outcome. But
well, thank you, sir, for your service. This has been an honor to be able to sit here and talk with you today, and I think I've taken up enough of your Friday morning. Again, thank you for your service to our country. Thank you for coming in here and sitting with us. I'm Patrick Campion, and I've been sitting with Mr. Charles Kettles. What's your official title? I'm sorry, I want to address you in the proper way. So what was your end rank?
Well, I retired as Lieutenant Colonel.
Okay. All right. So would we address you as Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kettles, or how do we address you?
whatever you feel comfortable with.
Well, you introduced yourself as Chuck, so how about we go with that?
That's fine.
All right. Thank you, Chuck, so much for being with us today, and thank you for being a part of Ypsilanti and a part of Eastern Michigan, and thank you for sharing your story with us here today.
Oh, you're very welcome.